Good evening, everybody. It's my pleasure to welcome you here to the British Academy for our event, Technology and Tax, Present and Future. As president of the Chartered Institute of Taxation, and coming from an in-house background myself, one of my goals for my year as president is to try and have greater engagement with and from the in-house community in the institute, and this event is part of that goal, or part of that drive, can I say? So I'm very pleased that you've all taken the time to come here tonight to hear our distinguished panel of speakers. Before I introduce the panel, though, I'd like to invite Pierre Forster from Longview, our sponsors for this evening, just to say a couple of words. Pierre.
Thank you, Glenn. Just a quick word to say we're delighted to be sponsoring this event. We are a vendor of software tax technology, and obviously the theme today was very appropriate. So when Glenn at a previous event said, Pierre, would you like to sponsor this event? We said, absolutely. So my name is Pierre Forster. I'm the general manager for Longview in the UK. We offer a solution for tax that covers areas such as tax reporting, operational transfer pricing, country-by-country reporting, and if you want to talk to us about it, I'm here with a colleague, Adrian. Adrian, why don't you sit up? When we have a few drinks afterwards, please do not hesitate to ask us about what we do, and we'd be more than happy to answer your questions. One thing as well, I want to thank you in advance, our great panelists tonight. I think they'll give some great insights. We've probably talking about the great aspects of technology and the frustrating aspects of technology. You, in your role as a tax professional, you will either love or hate technology. I think it is here to stay, and you'll get more and more of it. So best thing is to learn to live with it and make the best out of it and get the best out of it. That is all from me. And a final thing, thank you very much, Glenn, for inviting us. And a little word for Lisa Drackley, who helped us with the organization. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pierre. And I understand Longview have a number of these collapsible coffee cups, but they are in limited supply. So do visit early to get your collapsible cup. I'll now introduce the panel. I'm delighted that we have four experts from the in-house arena to address us tonight. I'm not going to give their full biographies. They are in your program. But we have Neil Harris, the Director of Tax, Treasury, Insurance and Pensions from BT PLC. Shan Sun, the Lead for Tax Innovation at Unilever PLC. Simon Upcott, a former Group Head of Tax at Vesuvius PLC, and very pleased that Simon could stand in at short notice for Lee Holloway, who unfortunately couldn't be here tonight, and Ali Kennedy, the Vice President, Group Tax at Sophos Group PLC. And Shan is going to lead off on artificial intelligence, the main theme. Shan.
Yep. Thank you, Galen. Hello, everyone. I'm Sean from Unilever as the lead of tax innovation. I kick off the topic as AI in tax. It's a glamorous word. I think whether we have artificial intelligence or not is a debatable philosophical question. So today I'm going to just concentrate on things I do on a daily job and the lessons I learned. So I think for those of you who are not very familiar with let's replace AI with data analytics and machine learning. That's pretty much what I do on a day-to-day job right now. So my first area would be the various different technologies we can use in tax. So I think the first, I would start from as tax professionals, we tend to sit in silos. So if you got qualified after CTA, you go into a particular area, you're either indirect tax person, transfer pricing person, direct tax person, pensions, you don't really talk to each other that much, we're like specialists. But when you start looking at where machine learning and data analytics could help you, that barrier start breaking down. So one area which is particular being used most right now is on classifications. So in tax, if you have a direct tax classification type of issues, like which means reading your invoices and determine whether this is deductible or non-deductible item, that's a classification, it's a binary classification. Sometimes it could be an indirect tax classification that comes in various code you have, particular from ship to ship from countries, material descriptions, they'll come down to a particular VAT rate. That's multiple class classification. So from a machine learning perspective, doesn't matter what kind of tax this is a very similar type of work, which is all in classification. So that's where we see most applications in. Following to that is natural language processing. So when I want to talk about the classifications, part of the things is when you have your ledger entries or you have your invoice descriptions, all sorts of things that are feeding into your model that comes with a classification afterwards, whether it's direct or indirect, deductible, non-deductible, or your fixed assets. The first bit where they start looking at the invoice descriptions or your ledger entries or trial balances, those are going through a natural language processing part. So that's what the technology is. That's embedded into your classification. But sometimes they can actually be used in various different places. At one point, you could look at chatbots, which are basically using NLPs to look at what kind of questions you could potentially answer. Now, I have some cautions about using chatbots. It's a very fancy word. It's quite a lot of people are doing, but whether it's really necessary or not is a different matter. And then the areas of forecasting and predictive analysis, so where predominantly what I see is in tax forecasting, ETR, effective tax rate forecasting, or cash flow forecasting for your tax provisions. These are very data-hungry type of issues you would need to actually get reasonable accuracies. And I think Neil is going to touch on the data part later on. And then what we call is a more analytics side of things, but in machine learning language, it's more like pattern analysis or pattern recognitions. So these are when people coming to you to say, oh, we need to do data analytics on indirect tax or data analytics on transfer pricing. Those are predominantly looking at your transaction level data and figuring out what the trends are, what kind of outliers are, or is there missing data, or is this repeated transactions. Those are things that are predominantly looking at the using the machine to look at your historic data to try to figure out if there's a particular patterns in it. So that's a very significant area I've seen machine learning being applied. And then corresponding to pattern recognition is image recognition. Unfortunately, in tax, it's really nothing exciting as cybersecurity, like Ali might actually mention later on. You have your facial recognitions, your fingerprint recognitions. We only have invoice recognitions or archived documents, like audit query files kind of recognitions. A lot of them are scanned copies from the last few years, or like even before the digital age. Now you get them, you kind of need them to be recognized. That's basically what you use image recognition for. This actually sounds quite straightforward work, but sometimes whenever your invoice or your particular documents has different formats or slightly complex models or tables on it, that could impact your recognition. Text recognition later on. But without these, none of these natural language processing classifications could work. You kind of need to feed into the machine with appropriate data for them. And then another area is real-time reporting and dashboarding. I wouldn't really call them specifically machine learning or anything. That's just naturally following whatever your ERP system is and kind of dragging them out and then doing some dashboarding because you have real-time data feeding in through. It's a big area, but it's not quite machine learning or data analytics in it. It has more like the reporting UI surface there. Some areas I haven't seen huge application, but I think there's some potentials are optimization. So there are something in tax, I think there potentially you could look at optimization problems like tax claims or some graphing, knowledge graphing for your tax audit files or for your legal cases. I've seen some products demoed to me, but I don't think they are quite there yet. So they're not quite as mature as I would have hoped. And then reinforcement learning, where I think you can probably hear all the hypes from the media about AlphaGo or StarCraft from OpenAI to try to get machines to learn how to play games. We haven't actually used that much in tax. I think predominantly it's quite hard area to apply because that requires very refined environments of you define your reward functions and you define your loss functions, but they also need a timed sequential steps in there. In tax, so we often don't have sequential steps, unlike chess, we do. So that's why I don't think reinforcement learning has been applied extensively, but I'm hoping to see a bit more. So next big area I want to talk about is the lessons I learned from the projects I'm looking after right now for machine learning and data analytics from Unilever and the previous jobs as well. The first area is data quality and data accessibility is very, very important. You could have all the great models you have, but if your master data was not correct, it doesn't matter. Your machine learning is not going to learn. You can't teach a kid to learn something from all the wrongdoings and expect them coming back towards a good behavior afterwards. So. At one point, if someone tell me, like, my master data is about 70% wrong, I can only say, I'm sorry, you have to go back, manually change your data, make sure they're correct before you can come to me. Again, Neil is going to talk about these data issues later on before I turn this into a massive rant. And then, second one is, for those of you who have listened to me before, I emphasize on problem identification a lot more than the technology itself. For me, if you don't know what your problem that you wanted to solve, it's almost no point for you to look at the machine learning. So your tax transformation or whatever digitalization process you wanted to do really have to come through what kind of business needs you have or what kind of business problem you have. But sometimes it actually comes from like what kind of data you have access. Like in transfer pricing, which my previous job was focusing on, we have CBCR data, which doesn't exist before. It was literally a concerted effort globally to try to get everyone fill that in. But all of a sudden, you have this accessibility, so you can actually start using them. The problem, the identification of problem will have a trickle-down effect for the rest of things that follows on your particular project. So another lesson I learned is to involve your stakeholders as early as possible. So your stakeholders here are not just the who approve your budget or who is going to work with you, developers or your IT people, but more importantly are the users you want to address. So quite often if you ignore them or kind of thinking, oh, there's TP documentation bots I need to do, but you involved them and vaguely tell them what to do, that's not enough. It's kind of, I did a lot of workshops, a lot of hand drawing to show people this is what I think you would think this is helpful, what do you think? So when you involve people from the very beginning, your baby become their baby too. So they would really want to see this as a progress and give you feedback. Sometimes you would be very surprised. You can have a very, very comprehensive model behind, but if your UI is not an intuitive button people can click and then just use it, they could just ignore it, and then nobody use it, and it's a failure afterwards. It's quite a shame. But sometimes I got a developer argue with me and say, like, on SharePoint, we got web component, I have to go find a different team to do this. Can't I just do a workflow, which do a drop down? I was like, no, because when you do a drop down, it's a lot less intuitive for people to use. It's worth spending that time getting the user feedback, ask them, is this okay for you? Or is this like something, oh, I have to log into SharePoint and click it? You'd be surprised. People sometimes would just not use it because of that one little step it didn't get looked after. And another thing I get asked quite a lot is how do you quantify your AI projects or your machine learning projects? This actually links back to when you identify your problem. If you identified your problem at the beginning very specifically, this shouldn't be a problem. You should be like, my KPI or my metric is, did I solve your problem? Did I address your problem? That should be directly measurable. But as a lead for innovation, sometimes I have very creative ideas. It's very difficult to define what the problem I try to address. It will be like something very unstructured data. I want to find some patterns out of it. It is difficult to agree with people how you're going to define your progress. So at that point, it is very important for you to say, at least at very first stage, what I think I can deliver and compare what you currently have. So if you're trying to address it, there's something you always see a human error. The fact you need to get the error rates originally is very important. It's actually quite difficult sometimes later on when you have a machine learning model give me an accuracy rate of 98%, and they ask me, is this enough? And I was like, well, I want to know what the human rate is, like how much errors the human did before you can measure me, right? And surprise, surprise, sometimes they don't even know themselves how many human errors they could have. They can only get it by the time they get audited. It's actually quite difficult sometimes. So I think that's something worth finding out, so that solve your problem later when you have different milestone well-defined.
One more point.
Sorry, I didn't realize it would be time to hear. So my last point is all about machine learning governance. So in my work, a lot of times it's classification models. So in the classification model, it's unlike the prediction model. So if you have a certain length, if you want to predict, you can actually compare that a month later. You compare how well you predict, that's fine. But in classification model, once your model is up and running, your training data and test data all on historic data. You have particular accuracy at 98%. How could you guarantee that going forward, when your model is seeing unseen data before, they will still follow that accuracy rate? You might not think, for machine learning practitioners, this is a particular area they are looking at particularly as well. Not a lot of good examples of how they addressed it so far. But for our tax people, we'll be like, okay, hold on a minute. If you actually start running this, no one is emphasizing how you actually get there. 2 years down the line, I got a query from tax authorities. My line of defense can't be the machine told me, right? You kind of have to have some kind of governance, what kind of rigorously I put in to make sure my model is robust and answer that question. At one point, it becomes a risk-taking exercise. It's probably not for me to decide whether we can take that risk for a machine learning model of like a certain level of accuracy rate. But it's very important that you have documented that and you have a line of defense on that. On that note, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Shan. So
we have a number of areas where AI, if we have AI, can be used to a greater or lesser extent. Some key learnings, and I think a lot of us will recognize the data quality, data access problem, whether we're using AI, machine learning or not. And yeah, governance, and definitely don't forget the line of defense can't be the machine told me. So thank you very much, Shan. Thank you. So, Neil.
Well, thank you.
Data.
Well, in the context of that, I think it will be much more pedestrian. I'd like to talk about sort of BT's experience because I think we're renowned as a fairly clunky, slow-moving, large corporate. Hopefully, I'll be
Is that any better?
Yes. So again, I just want to give BT's perspective here. Hopefully we'll feel better when we leave. But I think, again, I know I'm talking on data. I wanted to make sort of three general points. First, I think people talk a lot about a technology, and I think they automatically go to machine learning and AI. And I suppose the reality that we face at BT is there's a lot of tech out there, which is in the consumer space, that can help transform us today without waiting for all the systems to be ready and without waiting, you know, in our judgment, you know, 5 years until these things really take hold. Second observation, tech doesn't really fix the perennial problems that everyone knows about getting the basic right. But there's a lot of things we are finding that there are ways of helping us out. You know, easy examples about how do you embed, you know, a RACI model within an organization. We're finding if we look in Oracle and how people are set up, there are things in there that can easily be adjusted to help you do that. We're also finding that simple things like Microsoft Teams can help us, pull together our uncertain tax position database. And we're also finding that the sort of corporate Facebook, workplace, I think it's called, is a really easy mechanism for delivering training around the organisation. And I think of themselves, you go, well, my children can use all of those, but when they're used properly within an organisation, I think they can start to deliver meaningful change that is within our control. And I think the last point is, as a professional, I'll just say we need to embrace. I was told a couple of weeks ago that my experience was just a portfolio of correlated binary outcomes, and I could soon be replaced by a robot. And I suppose on reflection, that's probably true. And I would say we need to embrace the language of technology to make sure that we keep repositioning ourselves, to make sure we're in what I'd call highest and best use. So on to data, I think there's a couple of ways that we look at data. I suppose the basic segmentation we have is the difference between accounting data and then tax data that we use for compliance and reporting, and tax data that we use for managing our tax positions. And when we look at that, we also look about the distinction we use is data that we use and the data we own. And we find those classifications start to help us really start to understand what are the challenges about data. And the biggest place that we start, and I think Shan mentioned it, is how do we demonstrate that, how do we ensure that reasonable care is taken, and how do we demonstrate that, potentially, 6 years later? And we're trying to use that concept as driving how we approach, how we use technology to help us, improve our data quality. We don't have the data, but basic robots, so basic robotic processes, our sort of internal view is they're more reliable than people. They're better in a defence against HMRC because you can say, this is what it did, and it did it completely, and I can give you the evidence to show that it did it. So this whole idea of sampling is starting to be something in the simple areas of something you go, well, why would you ever sample? And to some of our youngsters, it doesn't. The computer doesn't get, and the robot doesn't get distracted by emails and go for a cup of coffee, and it sends me reassuring emails on a Sunday evening saying that it's checked, 11,000 files. So, I think in there, in terms of reasonable care, I think that's a good step forward. And I think that again, the point that Shan was making, machine learning. Again, we need to be able to understand what it does. We're unfortunate that we are still SEC registered and we have SOX obligations, but one of the tenets of SOX now is that you can't meet an appropriate controls environment if you don't know what either third parties are doing for you or if you don't know what robots are doing for you. So this onus on you to understand what they're doing, to me, feels like it's something that's going to emerge in the area of reasonable care. So then moving on into, the biggest challenge, everyone will say, is data quality. Our battle that we've had is, it's sort of a them and us battle, which is, I'm happy that I own data that I have manipulated, but I should be able to rely on data that I take from the basic either accounting systems or billing systems. And this is a huge battle that we have to fight, and it's about organisational culture, it's about the whole organisation's DNA. And we've won quite a few of these battles, we've lost some of the others, but I'm going to remain positive. And how we engage with that is, I'm quite happy. If I can take a piece of data out of our accounting systems and it says you spent £100 on training, I need to know that that is what it is. And we come on to how we validate that, but we can't find out, 2 years down the road that it was actually just, cigarettes and alcohol. So we're saying that that is not our responsibility to chase that. We should be able to place reliance on that in an organisation. Clearly, we get lots of pushback on that. And in our case, we've had a couple of very large ticket items that have opened the way, to the message that we're bringing. So nothing like the old adage of nothing like a good crisis to help, further your cause. The third thing we're pushing on is simplicity, which ironically we always explain as negative complexity. But what we're trying to do as our overall approach is to say, We want to avoid complexity in our system, and we have huge numbers of systems. So how we interpret that is saying, I want all the tax information to be somehow attached to that data, so that I don't have to go and find other things. And that's a really good statement. There's easy ways to do it in certain areas. But there are, you know, the areas where we're having to work with people like procurement. We're trying to push obligations onto our suppliers. You know, we're a big network company, so we spend a lot of CapEx every year. And we're saying, well, our objective is, if anyone's doing a significant amount of CapEx for us, when it comes into the system, they have to have the tax characterization of it already done. And it either needs to be on the invoice or some supporting document so that our basic robots can go and find that. And then you have the debate about who's liable for it. So we're saying, well, we're going to start to publish our policy on, you know, we build telecom stuff. We broadly know what it should be. So our suppliers should be able to use, you know, playbooks or internet stuff that we give them to help do that classification. So that when you go through in your tax compliance, most of the stuff, most of the CapEx is done apart from the really tricky areas, which really helps. So then in terms of what are we doing as an organisation, you know, we've got a data lead, and we see that person as a bridge between our world and the systems and accounting world. And we don't see that as a person that's just been rebadged, who used to be called a tax compliance manager. I know other folk are talking about it, but it's someone with different skills. And we find this really useful, but in reality, it's one of those horrible jobs that you would never particularly want, because I think you are, overall, you're accountable. We're saying to our data lead, you're accountable for all the end-to-end processes and to make sure that appropriate controls are in place, but you're not responsible. Other people in the organisation are responsible. So, you know, it's the jobs you always avoid, in my opinion, accountability without responsibility. But that's the reality that we face today, and I think that trying to improve our data quality is really making sure that we focus on that. And there's a couple of things to help. You know, one positive thing I found in SOX after however long it's been, 15 years, you know, some of their characterizations of control is starting to be really insightful now. They have these definitions of end-user computing information used in a control and management review controls. And when you actually look at it positively, they are really asking you the important information. You know, if you've got an Excel spreadsheet, how are you sure it's right? So we can start to use that learning in how we define our control environment for our data. And that is useful. It's the only positive thing I'll say about Sarbanes-Oxley. The other thing we've spent a lot of time on is defined data handoff points. So this is where we take information from the accounting world, if you like, and we've now imposed two requirements. We want to make sure that the person who's giving us that data is appropriately qualified, and they need to give a positive assurance that the controls they say they've run have run. And we can use basic sort of workflow software to manage this, and it provides you the audit trail that things have been run correctly. And if you're feeling negative when they don't work so well, you know who has a training need and where you need to communicate better. We also make sure now that anyone that provides us data, they're doing it not as a favour to us as an organisation, but it's in their job description, and then we can go and find that job description on, in our case, Oracle or SAP, so that we know if they move on, we know that the requirements will pass on to the next role holder, and it's not just, you know, something that someone does because, you know, they like us. So other things that we do, just a couple more highlights then. I think some of the things, I think we have a positive experience with chatbots. I think in terms of our AP staff who are sitting generally in India, we find it's much more useful to have something that pops up on your screen and says, are you sure that you've got the right tax code for this, yes or no, than assuming that they'll just read the manuals and they'll remember the training. And again, it comes back to when we pick up the data in our three lines of defense, any data we take, we have access databases predominantly. We interrogate any data we're given and do the analytical review ourselves. So where we do find errors, we can feed that back and work out how the errors got into the system. I was going to talk a bit about data we own ourselves, you know, things that we have databases for transfer pricing, global tax risks. And I've talked a bit about the technology we have in the tax department. We've had robots. I suppose the other two things just worth mentioning, visualization tools. We've started to use these once now because we have better data, and it really helps us communicate and understand issues with the wider organization. And it sounds very grand, but at a basic level, you know, you could say it's just, you know, conditional formatting in Excel that most people can do. But we're finding there it really helps us identify trends in our tax risk data, and it really helps us map the organisation where the controls in the data aren't working. So we can say, oh, we've got an issue, say, in India, and it's in this department, or it's in Bristol, and it's these people. And then I think the last thing, in terms of managing and making better decisions, we've started, and it is rather grandly named, but we've started doing stochastic analysis when we make big decisions. And here, I think it used to be known as sort of Monte Carlo simulations, but we found, you know, certain issues that are, you know, very large. You know, an opinion from advisor doesn't really cut it if they say you've got 40% chance of success. You know, so we've now got the data in there, and it's a simple tool. You can buy it off the shelf that runs all the permutations 50,000 times. So you can see the distribution of outcomes, and you know, you can do all the stuff that you know you do in Treasury Department, saying is it a normal distribution? Is it about the mean? Is when we say that this is the mean average or the median, how likely is it you're going to have outliers? And I think that is, you know, early stages that we're doing, and we're trying to get more sophisticated. But certainly the feedback we've had from our audit committee is our level of insight has gone through the roof now. So that's what I was going to say.
Right. So yeah, so there's plenty of tech out there that you can already use. The robots can help you make sure you've got reasonable care with your information, because they don't get distracted, they don't go for coffee, but they do rely on data like the rest of us, and you need to make sure that data is reliable getting into them. We'll need people with different skills. I think that's a theme we're going to see. And I knew stochastic analysis would eventually come into tax. I've been predicting it for about 10 years. So I'm delighted it's finally getting there. So thank you. Thanks to Neil. So it's over to Ali, who's going to talk about using tech people in tax and using tax people in tech, I think.
I think I've got it right.
So if I understood the remit correctly, Glyn asked me to talk about the humans, whether they're humans who would designate themselves as tax people or technology people. But yes, the pesky humans. Let's wake everyone up, throw a question out to the room. Who reliably knows what an API is? It's okay, I won't test you. So it stands for an application programming interface, and basically it is a software intermediary that sits between one program and another. So someone in our work once described me as an API, that I was the soft interface between technology and tax, because I'm a director of a cybersecurity company, but I'm also the group head of tax. I'm a pretty decent hacker, and I'd still like to think I still know something about tax. So they think of me as the departmental API that sits between the techies and the finance people. And I think it's really important now for tax people to not worry about having to speak both languages. You don't have to be brilliant at it, but there's definitely nothing to be afraid of. And at the moment, I don't know how you guys feel, but I feel that heads of tax are currently inundated with large firms coming to us with solutions for things and technology solutions. And we're almost blinded by demos of things, you know, particularly some of the larger accounting firms have some really funky stuff, and you know, don't hesitate to demonstrate it, and the tax people in the team go, oh, I don't understand that, what are we going to do with it? So I think as a head of tax, it's important to start embracing it, get your head around what is out there, and in particular the advance of making tax digital has got us very, very interested, because it does feel a bit like a virus going around the world to us, that more and more countries, it usually starts with indirect tax and then it's creeping into direct tax, and countries are actually expecting us to connect to tax authority systems on what they would like to call a live basis, and that's pretty scary for tax people who are sort of still concerned with getting off Excel. So where do we start this journey? The first thing, I completely agree with Shan that you have to define the problem. And your problem is probably getting good quality data out of your accounting system, doing something with it, and then either getting it to the tax authority or getting it into your forecasting process. And in the most simplistic terms, that is the problem that you're trying to define. So how do we grab good data and hope that it's still good data by the time it gets to the end of this process? And tax authorities at the moment are very good at saying, hey, we've released all our APIs, developers, go and develop something that will let companies connect to our systems, and then they can just feed all of this data in. And you can have expensive connections to tax authorities, or you can have free ones. My advice to you if it's free, the company's making its money from somewhere, so you maybe want to worry about what it's doing with your data. But you know, API has been published in the UK alone. I think there are hundreds, maybe 300 different vendors
MCD.
In the UK. Something like that. And sitting here as a head of tax and someone says, well, which one? You know, the answer is clearly the most secure one, because I don't want to be responsible for our organisation being hacked, as I'm sure Neil would agree with. You know, your data is your most valuable commodity. So this is one thing that your in-house staff to get their heads around is, what is the problem? It's getting data out of the system through whichever piece of software you choose to use, and getting it to the tax authority. So the thing I would encourage you to do is approach your technology department. Don't try to solve it as a tax person. Most companies now have techies. We have thousands of them. And if you say the word tax to them, they'll look very frightened. If you say, I'd like you to hack a problem for me, they look quite thrilled. So the way I initially presented it was, I want you to hack the tax authority and get this chunk of data securely into there, please, and don't get arrested. And you're presenting them as something that they understand. So, you know, you have your ERP system. We're ruthless about simplicity, single charts of accounts. We're a very acquisitive company. When we buy groups, we give them 3 months to get on our systems, and that's it, and they're measured on their ability to do that. But you want to get this data out of your system, do something with it, manipulate it. Now, if you approach your tech department, you can say, well, don't say the word tax. Here's what I want to do with this. I need you to apply a set of rules. And coders, they just work with rules. Tax people just work with rules. It's pretty straightforward for them. You just encourage them to sit down, work through the rules, work out what you want the robot to do. And these guys are usually pretty keen to solve the problem, because for them it's just another hacking problem. It's how do we take something from here, do something with it, and put it there. And we've had a lot of success with getting our techies to just write simple tools for us to manipulate data and to clean up data. And that's the biggest thing, is cleaning up data. But on the other hand, you can take a tax person, and I'm not suggesting we teach them to code from scratch, but you can give them tools that are probably lying around your organizations at the moment. Tools like Alteryx are lying around. And your organizations can take these data wrangling tools, and a tax person can put a few rules into this. They can take data, they can clean it up, and they can still use spreadsheets. They're still comfortable, because this all works with Excel if they wanted to, and they can bring this data into something that's usable, and they don't need to be coders to do it. You know, these programs have very simple tutorials and rules, and you can do quite a lot with your data just using these simple tools. And techies tend to be very good at sitting down with the tax people to do this. And you can start with a problem that's thousands of lines of data, apply either simple robots or these tools, and you can crunch it down to just what you need and run reports. Again, the pain is if the data going in is terrible, it's going to be complete nonsense. Data clarity and data quality is everything. And we extensively use chatbots to help with data entry, just to guide staff, particularly AP staff around the world. Like BT, we have an Indian processing centre, and we use chatbots extensively to help get the data in there and for it to make sense. So what I've described is not an expensive transformation project. We don't throw lots of money at tax and finance teams. We throw lots of money at tech, but not at the back office. And all of these things we've been able to do in-house just by talking to the techs and getting their help to solve problems. I can't be from a cybersecurity company and not say something else about APIs. You have to understand cybersecurity, the very, very basics. You're connecting to tax authorities all across the world through various Making Tax Digital programs. And you can't just throw your data out there into some intermediary and hope that nothing happens. It's an absolute nirvana for hackers, and we see it all the time. So become familiar with spear phishing, with social engineering, with man-in-the-middle attacks. They are all really half an hour's tuition, and you'd be comfortable with all of those. And it helps you talk to the API providers, talk about what's going in the middle, how your data is going to be protected, because the last thing you want is you think you're sending something out there, but something can easily be sent back into your organization. And that's really what you're trying to avoid, that you need to keep your organization secure. You need to know what's happening to your data every stage of the game. And you have to make sure that you're not inadvertently receiving data that you would rather not have. And I think this is particularly important if, like us, you're a UK outbound and you have some large core businesses across the globe, but you also have lots of tiny businesses in countries where, you know, you might just have sales teams in and you might just be doing a small amount of work. But these countries might require digital submission if you look at Brazil and countries like that. So don't just go to a vendor and say, please submit my data live on the tax authority website. Use your tech teams, and it's a great way to get to know your tech teams. If you go up and say, hey, I've got to submit data to a tax authority in such a country, teach me a bit about how to make this secure, start building the bridges and the bonds with these people, find out if they can code and build robots for you. But that's often a first introduction to say, hey, law says I have to do this. How do I secure it? How do I make it safe for the organization? You're not asking them to do a tax calculation at that point, and you can start building the relationships within the teams, and that's certainly how we approached it. I don't know if there's anything else particularly I want to say. I think it's, if you want to future-proof your tech, and what to future-proof your tax department, it's all about keeping it simple, keeping the data as clean as possible, as few different systems as possible, so that when you start writing and applying rules to this and creating robots, you're not trying to create the whole universe in one go. Just take parts of the system, apply simple rules, and rigorously simplify everything as you go along. Because if tax authorities are going to be digital and live, they will have to simplify. They can't carry on increasing complexity if they expect to be able to do something with live data feeds. I think that's about it.
That's great, thank you. So,
be the human API between the tax guys with the rules and the software guy with the rules, and make sure that those people link up and understand each other's rules. Don't try to solve as a tax person. Get your tech team involved and ensure that they understand the rules that they need to be working to solve your problem. And then I think yeah, again, make sure. You can clean up some data by tax people. You can get tax people to clean up data by some, you know, before they put it in. I think I got that. There's some products out there.
And when it comes in a completely disastrous manner, there are some handy tools to improve it as well.
Some handy tools to improve it. So that we can do that as tax people, so there's at least something we can do. Yeah. Chatbots, I mean, that's a couple. The chatbots are coming up quite a lot, and using. I love the idea of the tax team talking to the AP people through a chatbot to make sure that classification is right. And APIs are a nirvana for hackers. So be very clear when you are using some proprietary software from somewhere else that it's secure and you're not exposing your company's accounting system to the world. So great, thanks. Let's say thanks to Ali. Finally, sort of Simon, who's going to sort of give us some reflections on what all this means for the future of the tax profession.
Yeah, great, thanks. Hello, everybody. Just want to make sure everyone understands, the fact that I'm the former group head of tax has got nothing to do with the topic of this discussion, right? It's got nothing to do with that, although it is quite advantageous at times, so it's somebody else's problem. No, just a different direction for me. I did some slides because nobody else had done some, but this is a kind of reflection on some of these things, because I think a great temptation with technology is, you know, rabbit in the headlights. What do we do? I think if you change the mindset and think in the terms of saying, well, look, we've all got difficult jobs, and not just in tax, we've all got difficult jobs. We've got to do a lot, we've got to give a lot, define the problem, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, if you embrace the technology as a means for doing that, I think it helps in the first place rather than getting too scared. So it's just some reflections. We've covered a lot of these. I thought I'd just put some drivers for change up there. I'm sure you can think of some other things. If I was to highlight a couple of extra things that we've sort of touched on, but just to draw out, you know, as to the reasons why we might look at technological solutions. One is around tax resource department budget constraints. You know, we're always being asked to reduce those costs. Okay, so can we embrace, is there a technology solution to embracing that problem, but without losing result and output that we need. So that's also something of a driver for change. So tax rules, then I've called it, do I look good in this, the fourth bullet point. Yeah, demonstrating value for money for tax departments as well. Again, it's related. We are in charge of tax department budgets. And we've got to demonstrate value, return on investment, those sorts of things. Are they getting value for it? Are we really embracing technology in a way that reduces those costs, improves the quality of what we get, and demonstrates to the outside world, or the rest of the company, that we really are on top of our game? The other point that I would just perhaps flag, the others we've talked through, but as the last one, the digital disruption. Don't underestimate how technology, you can bring in technology just to deal with the fact that the tax rules are changing. Yeah, forget about the need for data quality and accuracy. That's all important. But actually, we could be in a situation where we're having to allocate profits in different ways, and we're going to have to be pretty flexible on how we look at that technology. And we in the tax department are going to be largely responsible for making sure we find those new profit allocations if that's what comes about. So just a few other little observations. The other things we've talked about, and I won't go through all those. The idea is perhaps to get a little bit of a discussion going. Anyway, I put that one up because let's face it, everybody just wants to push a button and then get success, right? We need to do our annual reports. Push the button. That's all that matters, isn't it? All you have to do is push the button, you tax people, and out it comes. Well, I think we've seen no, that's not the case. In fact, we're probably, some of us, a little bit more in this area. Okay? This kind of says we need the superpowers. Well, again, embrace it, embrace the need for it, and it's a positive mind towards these things. Technology can help us. Anyway, tax departments of the future, therefore, I mean, what we've heard very clearly, it's not a future, it's already with us. It's a current. In fact, for some people, it's a past already, all right, in terms of the need for technology. So we've got to grasp hold of it, get on with it, move along with it, okay? So some of the points to ping out. Yes, I think when you look at a tax department, yes, we are, and as we've heard, you know, where do the technologists, where are the people who are going to give us that equipment to do the technology that we require? Now, is that within the tax department, outside the tax department? It's great for Ali as part of a technology rich company. But in my area of engineering manufacturing, we don't have that luxury of being able to talk to people who are really deeply into some of the technology. And I'd love to be in that environment. So embracing technology specialists is a tough one. And it's great to hear with Unilever and at a lot of other places, yeah, technology, tax technology lead or whatever, they're common job titles now. You see that. So embracing into tax department those new skill sets is going to be increasing trend, I think. And speaking as one who comes from the FTSE 250 rather than the FTSE 100, that's quite a problem because it's not the way you tended to think. As we've already touched on, closer integration of tax accounting and IT departments. Who takes charge of the data? Common problem that I've found, even without the need for speed and more technology. It's just getting who is responsible for that data? And with it comes who's responsible for quality, quantity, etc., etc. That needs a grown-up discussion pretty early on, especially if you're using technology, I think, as we've heard. Obviously, then there's leveraging technology. It's with us. We've got repetitive processes. Most people would say, therefore, you must be able to find some technology solution to do repetitive, systematic processes. Easy to say, pretty difficult to deliver. Okay? Because you've got to change people. You've got to bring people on that journey. So yes, robotics, yes, analytics, etc. But again, go back 20 years, it's not what a tax department was used to. It was just producing information. Obviously, systems training. Do we really in the tax department understand all the systems that are producing the data that we have? So you look at your tax departments. I've spent quite a bit of time pushing people out to make sure we fully understand those systems. Data and systems audits. I think we've heard from Neil quite clearly there that he's getting quite a lot of assurance or the need for assurance of the data they're getting. So how do we embrace that within our tax teams? Is it an internal audit issue? Well, internal audit are not going to thank you for this, but how do you integrate that in? Flexible staffing, because some of these things are little here today, gone tomorrow projects that you need. Certainly, we're at Vesuvius, we're looking at bringing in people for specific little projects in the technology area. I'm bringing them in to use them to set things up. But actually, it's short term, so you don't have permanent staffing necessarily for some of these things. The need for some flexibility. Education, just take it right back to square one. I didn't have any technology training when I was learning my trade in tax. Is that something right at the point of entry, whether it's CIOT or accounting bodies or wherever the training is going? It strikes me that we need to see more around systems, data production, quality, assurance, this sort of stuff, actually at the education coalface as well. And then the other obvious things, invest in data analytics. That was always seen as something that the accounting teams did. But actually, I think we in the tax need to embrace that as well and get used to it. Everybody will need to do the data analytics. Obviously, technology, maybe that becomes an increasing element of our annual staff, sort of tax department resource budgets as well. We need to embrace it. We're sort of used to having headcount things, but technology and investment technology gets to be a bigger element, I think. And slightly controversial, the last one, where do you get your advice from? And do we get it? We're always saying advice and advisors are very expensive, etc. Can we reduce that cost? Well, so it's a challenge to advisors. Can any of your advice be given by a robot? I don't know if maybe you haven't, but if you've been to see your GP lately, you go in, so I've got my left little toe hurts, all right? And they will sit there, look it up on a web, and then deliver to your inbox the answer. Well, if they can do that, how about maybe more standardised advice? Can we do that as well? So there's a challenge there also, I think, therefore, for the advising profession as well. Can we get that more effective? Anyway, look, there's a few thoughts just to kind of get us going. I don't think we're going to be push of a button stuff, but there's a lot we can do to embrace the technology, and it does affect how we run our tax departments.
Thank you, Simon. I'll just pull a couple of things out there. At the last point, PwC out there, I can see EY, I know, are out there. Can some of your advice be given by robots, Adrian? but yes, and then for the education, the educationalists, I suppose I must include myself among that group. You know, what are we going to do? More about systems, more about data production and validation, more about data analytics, maybe less about tax and section numbers. So thank you, Simon. We are running slightly over. It's 7:30 now, but we will aim to take questions for up to half an hour, depending on how many questions we get. If it's less than half an hour, you get slightly longer to drink. If it's more than half an hour, you get slightly less. So who's got a question for the panel? I think we're only one at the moment.
Hi, thank you for those very interesting talks this evening. One thing that you all mentioned was data quality, and as an in-house tax person, I can fully agree with that. What advice do you have to in-house tax people around the room in potentially smaller companies about how you actually tackle data quality? And how do you improve it? Because I know Ali mentioned using chatbots, but that we might not be able to afford those. So what advice have you got for people how to improve data quality?
I'd like to go first. Neil, go on.
I suppose my advice would be that make sure you understand the technology out there. I think there is some really easy wins. And I think a lot of things can be solved. Most people in the organisation don't put in bad quality data on purpose. And so I think there's training and education, which I think with simple Instagram, Snapchat, all of those things, you can deliver. If you work out who your customers are within the organisation, if you look at the cause of poor quality data and you find the people associated with it, I would go with communication first. And also following up and making sure that you don't just accept data and that you do some kind of checks, and that can be basic Excel analytical review, is my output tax 20% of my bills, that kind of stuff. And that starts to bring this theme of quality into an organisation. I think there's interacting, if you do have, we have something called our tax technology strategy, and you look at it and it's a bit basic, but what it gives us is the opportunity to speak to our head of IT every few months to share ideas and work out what's coming. So I think develop that engagement with the people that can help you.
Can I just make a comment on the one? I feel your pain. Right. I think you can't leave your brain at home. All right. You can't just wait. Push the button and come and necessarily take that answer. Right. So I think you do have to look at that and say, well, but what I'm seeing, does it make sense? And even with something like, CBCR or something, when you get that sort of information out, you sort of think it's gobbledygook, right? It's aggregations. Actually, there's probably more in it than you think. So, sit there and just look at, does this make sense to me? I don't think you can ever not ask yourself that question. Yeah. Now, you may not know all the detail. We didn't use chatbot stuff, but we'd certainly use sort of real time conversations, which you can just buy through. It's part of Outlook packages and Microsoft packages. And as much as anything, because it's sort of easier because you can keep it going. It's not taking up your time on a phone call and you can't find the person in. It keeps it going. I think what that means is that you have to give yourself, the other point I'd make is you have to give yourself time to make sure that assurance is put in place. So you have to ask up intelligent questions about it and give yourself the time. It's very, very practical.
I think to me, data quality has two areas. One, your legacy data. I'm afraid those ones is already bad data. You just have to use manual labor to check them, clean them. Then going forward, for me, to ensure data quality, part of them is on your data design, how you want to design it. First, your structure. Do you follow a master data approach? Therefore, when you do your master data, it has to be with the rules and validations and controls. Or are you having just literally people key in data manually, in which case your chatbots to ask you, would it be helpful? I think it's also a cultural change. Like, people need to understand whatever data goes in, like if it's wrong, what the consequences are, and then they need to be liable for that as well. If they understand that, the liability lies with them. And I think Neil, like maybe someone mentioned about the ownership of the data. Sometimes I felt like, say if the master data wasn't correctly done, like the quality was bad in the first place. Quite often it's because no one knows who owns this. No one knows who's, like, some people use it for sure, but they will say, oh, some other team did this. So I think ownership is quite important for the data quality issues. And also there will be guidelines and, what is, again, back to your design. Data quality comes from what is accurate. Do you have missing data? Do you have outliers? Do you have repetitive kind of things? There are various issues where you get back qualities. For each area, do you have a rule of how to catch them? And when you catch them, what do you do with them consistently? That's all lies in the original data design. Thank you.
I suppose I have sympathy if you aren't in a large organization, as you say, where you have all of these tools. The one thing I would focus on is simplicity, because if you create complex ways of capturing, reporting, and dealing with data, you're expecting humans to get their heads around them. And, you know, staff change, you know, whether they're promoted and they move on or whether they leave. So if you are creating systems and processes that are so difficult to understand and follow, you have to expect a high error rate. The other thing we do is we don't always clean up. That we have a team of accountants, and their job is to make things simpler. Now, this isn't the full-time job for any of them. This is a job of probably a couple of hours a week in our committee that removes surplus legal entities, removes surplus ledger codes. Their job is to go and seek things that are difficult and make them easier. And our accountants rotate in and out of this group, so you have people with different strengths and different disciplines. But their entire job is to simplify so that people who are starting and new people coming into the business who are learning the job aren't faced with something overwhelming from the beginning. And you tend to get fewer errors if you can keep the rules as straightforward as possible.
Give you a chance to think about some more questions, because I've got a question for the panel. So Jeremy Coke is over there, who's the president of the ATT, and Helen Whiteman's here, who's the chief executive of the Chartered Institute of Tax. Now, Jeremy and I are going to talk to Helen about what type of exams we're going to need in the future, and if we need those exams in 2 or 3 years' time, we now need to start planning the syllabus today. So should we be looking at setting new tax exams for technology people or new technology exams for tax people? Maybe I'll pass that back to Ali.
I suppose to some extent it doesn't matter, because what you're looking for in this space are problem solvers, and they can either come from tax or come from technology. I like the idea of hiring technologists and teaching them tax, because I think there's a bigger mental block to learning technology from scratch than tax. I don't think it's more difficult, I just think there is a bigger mental block. And certainly in our universities at the moment, we see a lot of undergraduates doing computer science with management as joint degrees. So these guys obviously don't want to be buried in the back room coding their whole lives. They want to run companies, or they want to run other aspects of tech companies. And I think there's a rich source there of people that we could train in tax. But as I say, what you're looking for are the problem solvers, which is maybe, I don't know, a slightly different approach to hiring.
maybe not, but not necessarily people who are good at sitting in the law library and learning huge numbers of lines of legislation, perhaps more mathematicians who like solving mathematical puzzles.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree
with that. If you, however, were to come across somebody who knew about tax and was desperate to know more on IT and was very good on IT, I just grab them very quickly because they're few and far between. My experience on this is that there is a need for maybe the slightly more dyed-in-the-wool sort of tax technical person to actually understand the power of technology and how to embrace that technology, because I think there is a fear factor in this. So if I was to try and make a choice there, I think it's certainly worth trying to help tax, you know, people who are learning the tax trade to understand how technology works. I would hope, having said that, that such a lot of university qualifications, and even before that, I mean, my kids taught me everything I knew about IT. There's an awful lot they can do with IT, and just encourage them to think through around it. But I would encourage people to understand what the technology requirements and abilities are as you do your training as a tax person.
Any other thoughts? I suppose two observations. I'll say one is I think there's a general we need to increase the importance of the varied skills and behaviours that are required by tax people. I think technology is probably it's in its ascendancy at the moment, but a technology person that can't communicate is just as bad as a tax person that knows nothing about technology. So I'd say, bringing out the overall portfolio, and maybe the time is now, because of the rise of technology, to really, hit that drum again, especially for in-house people. And I suppose, the other observation, again, something I was told, I don't know if it's true, is, the half-life of a skill that you learn through training is dropping from the stat that was given to me, 20 years to 5 years, which I think people are coming into tax as a career can't be either fortunate or unfortunate like us to say, I'll learn that, and then that'll keep me going for most of my career. So I think the idea that things will rotate through, the need for continual learning, the need for continual changes of skills, I think that's another piece that we should emphasise.
I agree on that one. Actually, I read that article about the decay of learning rates. That's actually specific for engineers, but I actually really do apply to tax. I just want to mention, the topical thing right now in machine learning is called auto-machine learning. Everyone's looking at how to automate the whole machine learning process to the point you really just need to chuck in your data set and then they'll churn out results for you. The problem is you need to understand how to interpret that. And actually, machine learning is really important for people to have domain expertise. If you know the biggest machine learning gurus, Andrew Ng, who started the whole Coursera courses for machine learning, he's learning neuroscience to try to figure out how he could help medical doctors. So for us, I think CIOT has this huge goldmine of the domain expertise, the teaching people on tax. I'm not saying it's unimportant for you to learn about technology. I think for all of them, it's for the gist of it, you need to understand the underlying principles. The same goes to machine learning and the tax. When I qualify with CIOT, I can say I qualify just means I can answer 50% right on my exam papers. What really matters to me is to understand how to learn that amount of tax legislations into a paper that I can roughly tell you which area of tax you try to ask me. I might not remember minute details, but I figure out a way how to learn them and how to keep that one. So the way you learn how to learn, for me, is more important than what you're trying to teach a person specific skills. Another really funny thing is nowadays when I talk to my coders, sometimes I would do the machine learning, the data analytics, the classifiers, those things myself. But when it comes to RPA coding, some of the JavaScript, I actually didn't do that when I was at uni at all. When I talk to the coders in India, I say, can you do this? They often come back to me and say, I actually never really use Excel, or I don't really use Word. I don't really know what your problem is. I have particular code. Their answer is my code doesn't read your paper. And I was like, I don't understand that sentence. You need to explain it to me. After he explained, I was like, do you not understand there's a title function in Word? That's why you can't read, your code can't read this text. And he was like, no. So are you saying, like, these are only a few years apart, so if you just teach someone to use Office Suite, like, after a few years, they're going to be another technology. To me, it's not much point for you to teach them specific technology, but the underlying function of logic in machine learning, that goes into text as well. Like, when I was learning text, a lot of times I can't memorize all of that, but if I try to figure out what is the gist of that text legislation, what they're trying to catch, and the principle of it, that goes a long way all the way throughout my career. I always go down to the nexus rule, always go down to the arm's length rule. That, for me, is more important.
There's quite a few people I can see in the audience who are not necessarily involved with either working for or advising the very largest companies. How much of this resonates with you in terms of when in your workplaces and with your clients? Does anyone want to volunteer any thoughts on whether they see this as really just a problem for the largest corporates, or is it going to affect everybody down to the down to the smallest companies? Anyone want to say? Yeah, okay.
Hi there. I'd say it's becoming normal. So back to your question, should you teach which direction tax to technology or the other way around? The future, in my mind, is that everyone is, let's say, tech-enabled. It's just a normal way of working. So therefore, it would affect all companies, any size. And everyone who works in a tax function or an HR function or any other function, it's just becoming familiar with the sort of skills that you've mentioned, the problem solving, the more generic ones, rather than the facts. So I think it becomes ubiquitous, I suppose. And therefore, for a tax function today, looking at where they've established themselves and where they want to get to, then the sorts of things I'd encourage most would be stakeholder management, speaking to other departments to try and get those skills. They probably exist, even in smaller companies, where perhaps you don't feel that there's going to be budget. The chances are that someone will be looking at these kinds of things. And so looking internally is perhaps a different thing just in itself than we've traditionally done when we've tried to just run our tax function solo.
Is anyone here from HMRC? Yeah, okay. I'm not going to put you on the spot too much, but the issue that Ali raised about APIs and intersects between corporates and HMRC. Now, I know MTD, we've really only put our toe in the water in the UK, but do you have any thoughts about how that's going to develop, and how is that sort of central to sort of HMRC's thinking in this area? If you're able to comment, that's great. If you're not, just say you can't. So, it'd be helpful to.
So, Tim East. I'm a technologist in HMRC, responsible for some of the systems supporting compliance. So, I'm not going to come at this from a sort of a tax integration perspective. I would more like, I think, to come at it from a, you know, how is business going to work? What are the developments? So things like blockchain, distributed ledger technologies, some of the process backgrounds that are inherent in things like GDPR, where the concept of data controller, I think, means more sharing of responsibility. So I think APIs are here to stay. I think business will work increasingly on the basis of either transactional or bulk transfers of information around the globe. And I think, therefore, whether it's HMRC or equivalent tax authorities or yourselves, as people supporting business or individuals, for that matter, in complying with obligations, APIs are here to stay, and therefore I think it behoves us all to work out how do we keep them safe, how do we keep the data safe, how, you know, potentially are we more open, how are we learning, for example, from open banking principles around sharing that responsibility so that it's easier for people to comply with whatever the obligation is. So I think that's that would be my answer, which is a bit of, you know, tech meets tax, rather than specifically answering your question.
Thanks very much. Thanks for that. Right, any more? Oh, yes, Kerry.
Thank you. Hi. I'm a corporate tax partner at a law firm, so coming at it from a slightly different angle. But just, I was interested in the panel's thoughts, actually, in terms of technology and diversity, in particular when you start looking at the impact on jobs over the future sort of 5, 10, 15 years, and you look at perhaps how some of the, you know, the middle management and lower tiers, perhaps jobs that are at the moment predominantly done by women, especially at the compliance level, if, you know, to the extent that they are, you know, in tax, what they see the impact being on females in the workplace, and in particular the kind of ongoing efforts to try and get there to be more senior females overall, and also looking at the tech sector in particular, and my firm specialises in advising tech companies, and they often are predominantly male at many levels, not just senior management. So it means that a lot of the machine learning, a lot of the coding, et cetera, being done at the moment is being done by men. And when I attend diversity circles and things, there seems to be some concern about the impact on having machine learning and AI developed primarily by men. So just really interested just to hear if they had any thoughts on that and how that was going to impact perhaps in the future.
A senior woman in tax and tech. I think I have to give that one to you.
So yeah, I was one of the founders of the Tech She Can project, and the issue we identified is that girls are rejecting tech by the time they are 10 years old. So it's a very difficult issue to solve, because when you advertise jobs, you're pool of talent is tiny, because they're not taking tech subjects, they're not taking computer science in schools, they're not studying it in university, and they're not graduating in technology. So by the time you get to the workplace, it is too late. You will probably be lucky to have 10% of applicants being female, which is very odd, because when you go back to the original coders and the original technologists in Bletchley Park and NASA, they were all women. And it's only in recent decades that coding became a male thing, and it goes back to schooling. Girls are being put off technology in school. So I don't think there is an easy answer at the company level. I think a lot of us are putting a lot of effort into going into schools with role models and with fun pieces of tech and things to do, and we take a lot of hacker challenges to school to try and persuade girls to study technology, to study computer science, maths at university, and that's where we're going to get the pipeline of the future. In terms of the women in the low-level jobs, and they're the ones who are going to be threatened by robotics. There are a lot of programs out there for women returners to work and to teach women to code. And you don't need to have done computer science at university to learn to code. So it's something that we're looking at. It's much more difficult with adults. But it's definitely something that the industry cares very deeply about, but we're not going to solve it overnight. There just aren't the numbers there to do that.
Thanks. Sean, do you want to?
I'm actually sitting on a committee for women in tax in London. So I don't think we actually address the tech-specific area for tax people, but it's probably worthwhile as well. I also know quite a few meetups that has for our ladies, Python ladies, so those are probably worth joining up. I do want to address on the fairness of the models. So right now in machine learning, machine learning model fairness is a huge topic, because we realize not only from the coder themselves, so probably male, a large chunk of them, but also the data itself is not necessarily all diverse, with the diversity included, or has a lot of issues in there. So that's an active area being addressed as well. For tax, we probably don't see that much of unfair issues in our, predominantly our data or financial data or management data. But when machine learning applies into different areas, especially like recruitment selections, the fiasco from Amazon using the AIs and has very, very particular finance issues in there. I think from non-practitioner perspective, it's just raising awareness, keep asking questions. And I think the movement of making sure e-cons adopting some third-party supplier data or model without understanding what's inside it is important as well. And I think whatever the model you are implementing, to make sure you're not getting a black box, but it's more like a white box model is important. At least that's what I'm very adamant advocating about this whenever I talk to my own companies and other people as well. You must understand what goes into your machine learning model. If they can't explain it to you in plain language, they didn't understand themselves. There's no excuse for that as well.
Neil, anything you want to?
Well, I don't think we've identified it as a specific trend within diversity. I think as an organisation, we're very focused on promoting diversity and changing the organisation to, meet different needs of different people. But I don't think we've picked up on that as a future trend. I think there's a couple of future trends that we have picked up on. We're trying to, like Ali says, work out how do we change as an organisation. But I think I will add that into the mix.
Yeah, just a quick
observation. I can't add anything really to what Ali said, but if you look at the diversity as well and look around the world and ask yourself the question, is that the same problem outside the UK? Because we kind of we're creatures of our own cultures to a certain extent. But certainly as I've looked around the world, then there is quite a lot of diversity in terms of who's doing what, but I'm not sure I see any different a demographic in this particular area. But business is increasingly international, and so when you kind of look at what technology brings, it means it doesn't have to be done in the UK. The UK market isn't necessarily the guide to what you do in the future. So you're going to bring on board an awful lot more nations and encourage a diversity right the way through, not just the genders, but right the way through the world in terms of what people can do for you. So, in China, in our organisation, if we had the choice, we'd be employing people in China. The intellectual property control is a bit difficult, but, that's where we would look. And certainly in China, if you look at the demographics of some of our support service teams, they are way closer to 50-50 than anything we got around the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I see that's a real challenge for the profession going forward, because at the moment, we entry into the profession, I think across a gender balance, is pretty much 50-50, if not possibly slightly more women coming into the profession than men. We've got some work to do to sort of keep that ratio as flowing all the way up to the top. Certainly not nowhere near that yet. That's something that certainly within the CIOT we're sort of committed to trying to facilitate. The worrying thing from picking up one or two things is if we start adjusting the focus of recruitment across the tax profession towards people who are more techie-minded, and at the moment it appears that that is predominantly male.
Graduates, it's about 90% male, 10% female.
We may see that diversity and inclusion going backwards, and that's something we've really got to guard against and work out how we can work around that. Anyone want to ask a final question? Otherwise, we're okay. Last one.
Hi, excuse me. Hi, I'm John Thurston from Vodafone and I work in transfer pricing. I'd just like to ask the panel whether they've got any examples of using technology to improve their transfer pricing methodologies or just improving the process in general.
Especially with the kilowatt coming on. So.
I can't solve pillar one, I'm afraid. In terms of transfer pricing, the technology you can see a lot of it is document management. So document management processes that work for anything else will work for TP, because you're having to take a fairly standard documentation set and tweak it for lots of different countries quite often. So, one of the things you can focus on is just using any sort of system that manages that. It doesn't need to be bespoke transfer pricing. In terms of actual processing of transactions, you're just back to rules. Transfer pricing people, I'll apologise for this, you have a way of making it very difficult. And I have this conversation with my TP director all the time. But again, bring it back to simple rules and automate as much as you can in the accounting system, you know, whether it's done with a robot or with a spreadsheet. But I think, you know, anything that works for any other aspect of your data will probably work for TP. Just try not to have too many different, you know, it's how many benchmarks do we have, how many layers do we have. If you can simplify it as far as possible, and there may be some appearance, we save more in tax if we sort of fine-tune all our benchmarks and fine-tune all of these different things. You can end up costing the organisation a fortune in complexity to save a tiny amount of tax. So look outside of the tax department and think, you know, strategically, how does this make sense? But I haven't always won that argument with my TP director.
Dan's got the magic bullet.
Yeah. The only one standing between you and the drinks, we can actually do a bit more. As an ex-tax TP person, there are quite a lot of things you could do. So very fundamentally, like tax TP reporting, right now I'm looking at data extractions. Should we do a TP data lake to go up and just to get your intercompany transactions out? Because different countries like IRS, India, China all wanted a line by line. Believe it or not, it's actually quite difficult for some companies, because the data ERP system in different places, to get that data connector to just extract that information itself is quite difficult. And then TP has a quite repetitive part of element of it, like your documentation preparations. So there will be like a workflow or RPAs could actually pull your data together. When you know the certain repetitive parts, you're going to put them together. That dressing on companies who's got over 1,000 subsidiaries, which normally I normally deal with before. I have heard about past attempt, but failed attempt on the NLP for transfer pricing documentation review for the benchmarking review. But I think it's probably worth another try, given the NLP progression in the last year or so. It's fascinating how much they progressed so far. And then another area, like I don't think we actually done that much. Oh, actually, the analytics part, where when you actually have got your intercompany transactions, then you start looking at the actual transactional level data. It should be easier for you to figure out whether each of your entities adhere to your TP policy. So whether you're doing profit splits or resale price or whatever that methodology is. It's an interesting question when you first mentioned like what technology would do for transfer pricing methodology. That is an area I think it could require some creativity in there. Actually, in my mind, there maybe you could figure out a game theory / optimization type of model to figure out what your optimal TP policy could be, but that could be like, you know, daydream, like in process. But yeah,
Thank you. I'm done. Right. Well, I think we've reached the end of the formal part of the evening. So I'd like to say once again thank you very much to Longview, our sponsors, to Pierre and Adrian. Do visit them before you go, and don't forget your coffee cup. And I'd like to thank you all for your for coming here tonight and for your engagement. And please do keep in touch with CIOT events. We advertise them all on our website, and nearly all of our events are open to non-members as well as members. We are an educational charity, educating for all, not just members. And could you once more put your hands together and thank our panel. Thank you.